What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Larry Rifkin and John Krofcig back at you for another episode of America Trends. And John, you know, some of the episodes and subjects aren't a mystery. They're pretty clear as to what it is we're going to hear because the topic is very focused and very specific. In the case of the next episode that we're bringing to you today, the subject matter really was hard to figure out at the beginning, wasn't
it? Well, yeah, especially the name of the book.
Well,
it does make it kind of confusing.
Well, the book is called Make Elephants Fly, The Process of Radical Innovation. Now, something like this, John, can go way off the tracks because we could get into the weeds with someone like him. And now, of course, he's in California. And so a lot of people are getting into the weed in California.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
I see what you mean there.
But we digress, and we'll hash over that at another time. But others, you know, other topics that we do, like this one, really are a mystery and enigma until we start them out. And until you hear the nature of the person on the other end and how giving they are. Because how do you really define radical innovation?
Wow. Well, we've had a lot of radical innovation, though. You really think about it through the years. I mean, it was pretty radical when they went to automate farms, right? That was very radical, and so on down the line into the computer and everything else.
But how do you make that process really interesting to people rather than just, okay, some really smart people got together. They figured out stuff that I'm never going to be able to figure out. And so why do I need to listen to this? But Stephen Hoffman.
He was good.
He was really, really good. Yes, and he really liked us.
Yes, yep.
And we've already recorded it, folks. So we know that. He liked us. And we liked him.
As a matter of fact, I think I remember, didn't he have that crazy message on his phone? Was that?
Yeah, that's right. What was that message?
Please do not call. No, please do not leave a message. I will not hear your message.
Right.
And then he would go on and on and on. And then I told him they should have a bomb sound or something at the end because I did wait online finally through all his don't leave, please don't leave, you better not leave. I left a message, but nothing happened. So I told him.
John worked really hard to get this guest here. So the least you can do is listen to what he has to say. And believe me, listening to what he has to say, and truly, if you're in the realm of wanting to figure out what your life is going to be like, recognizing all the disturbance that is upon us, and yet you want somebody who has done it, somebody who has built different companies, somebody who has helped others to incubate their own firm, you've got to listen to this guy, and he makes it very, very enjoyable.
He does.
So he takes that process of radical innovation and brings it down to a level where guys like me can really understand it.
No, it's really worth listening to. It's really a fun interview. It really was. He was a fun guy.
And he is the captain, they call him, Captain.
Captain.
And CEO of Founders Space, and that's ranked a top 10 incubator by Inc. magazine and the number one accelerator for startups coming to Silicon Valley from overseas in Forbes magazine.
That's even funny. Incubators and accelerators.
Yeah. Wow. Well, you've never heard of that? Of course you have.
Yes, I have. But
this is the buzz that's going on everywhere. In fact, my daughter's very involved in helping black entrepreneurs.
Chicken eggs.
Okay. Well, you're thinking of something that is somewhat in the past, John. Now, listen, I think it's really important to understand that the way he shares this information is the way that he has shared information with some real smarties out there. I mean, those who want to be the next Google or Apple or Facebook. And he does it in a way where the minute he said whatever he said at the beginning of this interview, I was captivated. I wanted to hear the rest.
No, he was. It's a good. It's really good. You got to hear this.
You really do. And it may all sound at the beginning a little technical and a little wonky, but trust me, it's anything but that. And John and I are very careful. I mean, there are a couple of podcasts, and John, we've never shared or disclosed this, but there are a couple that we've done that when we didn't think at the end they provided us with what it was we thought we were going to get, we just deleted them.
That's right.
We didn't use them.
No, that's true. You know, I mean, it happens.
And we bought studio time. I mean, here we are spending money, but we wanted to respect you and what you had to hear. And I'm telling you that this is going to be the best money you never spent to hear information that you may never otherwise get from a guy whom you may never meet. I mean, how do you like all that?
I'd like to meet him. Yes.
A lot of nevers.
He seems like a fun guy.
Oh, he really does. I love this guy. I really do. So if there is a podcast analog today, well, Stephen explains. Let me just say this. There was a movie called Goodbye, Columbus. Yes. Do you remember this movie?
I do, vaguely. That was a while back.
Well, way back. And Philip Roth wrote the novel that this was based on. And Richard Benjamin and Ally McGraw were in this. Now, it was about a young Jewish guy of a lower caste meeting a rich Jewish girl. And she was home for the summer. And she needed a little plaything. And he was the right plaything. And he could see that it was all kind of unwinding at the end of the summer. And they had had a glorious summer. Believe me, one summer with Ally McGraw. I think that's all you needed at that time.
Back in those days.
But he was at a wedding. And again, fall was upon them and she was going to be leaving and he knew that things were changing. But there's a great scene in there where and Stephen really in his own way explains to me what it was that I saw in this scene where you had this brother saying, why is it? And he's walking with Philip Benjamin. Why is it that my brother Morty had all this success and I have more talent in my pinky than my brother Morty. And yet, look at me. I'm a schlub. I've never done anything. And, you know, that's the beauty of what Stephen Hoffman offers us today. It's not magic. It's not just pure genius. It certainly is not just luck. There's a combination of all of that that has to be right and in play at the moment in time for something really to launch. And he explains how you make elephants fly. How do you do it?
Wow.
And you can do it. You don't have to be like that guy with his brother Morty. Why, God? Why was he successful? Well, we're going to answer that today.
Let's
with Stephen Hoffman.
It is so great to be talking to Stephen Hoffman, the author of the book Make Elephants Fly, The Process of Radical Innovation. And Stephen, not that I think that this is getting a little hackneyed, but everywhere we go, everybody talks about the process of rebirth and regeneration and innovation, and none of the old things can survive. I mean, how do you even begin to deal with writing a book to help people understand this process of innovation?
Well, if you think it's bad now, it's only going to get worse.
Oh, thank you for that, Steve.
You know, the whole idea that you have to innovate to survive, you have to change, you can't have things the same, that has always been true throughout history. I mean, look at, you know, every civilization that rose and fell. Look at all the inventions that we've had. But the one constant in history has also been that innovation has been accelerating, meaning, you know, humans have been around over 100,000 years on the planet. At our beginning, you know, our biologically, we were the same as we are now. But for us to develop new tools and acquire technology and learning took us a long time. So there really wasn't much progress in the first, 98,000 years.
Well, you trace it, of course, to the printing press in Gutenberg.
Yeah, well, you know, it was even before that that we started to make real progress with the Sumerians and the numeric system and all these different things coming out. But it kept accelerating. So even during the Middle Ages, right, things were pretty static. Like you could jump 100 years forward or 100 years back in the Middle Ages, and you really wouldn't notice much in the way of a technological change. when it really started to pick up steam, we sort of see that inflection point where things just started to go, was the printing press, because that allowed us to disseminate knowledge in a way we could never have done before. So printed books, printing them over and over and getting them out in mass to the population changed everything. Everybody had access to knowledge they had never had before. And then things have just kept going, you know, with the telephone, the television, the radio, and the internet. Each one of these inventions has allowed us to educate ourselves so much better, to take the knowledge we have and share it around the world much faster. And in the world we are in the world we're in today, I mean, literally, you can have an invention in Silicon Valley, and boom, it's on TechCrunch or any of these blogs, and it's around the world. Everybody's copying it. Everybody's learning from it. Everybody's trying to do the same thing. And with billions of people and billions of minds plugged into the internet, that is why people are looking at their businesses and realizing, wow, what we thought was true today, what we thought the normal way to do business today, will not be the normal way to do business, not in 10 or 20 years, but literally in 1 or 2 years.
And if you are a big established business and you've been working on your processes for a long time, you're married to them, your technology, your engineers really trust it, and then all of a sudden this upstart comes along that has 10 people who are innovating out in Silicon Valley, and they kneecap you, and you say, what happened here? I mean, how common is that? Is it better to be really mobile and have a lot of flexibility in these times versus being as established as many companies are?
So the problem is, when you are big and established, a lot of times innovation comes to a grinding halt in your organization, because you are big and established by the very nature of your organization. There's a structure there, and structures, people, when they're in a structure, they don't want to change. There's a huge amount of inertia. You have a startup, and they are free from all the constraints of the organization. They don't have to report to their boss. They don't have numbers to meet, their quota, either on sales or their P&L statement to worry about. They don't have all the bureaucracy of the organization. They can just take a new technology that they're interested in and apply it to that business and see what happens.
And in your book, Make Elephants Fly, you remind us, it's not generally about the technology itself, but about its application. And Steve Jobs is probably the best example of that.
He is a great example. So Steve Jobs' technology, and Apple in general, has never been the most cutting edge. I mean, they took literally to build the first Apple One, they're taking off-the-shelf parts and putting them together. And with the iPhone, if you look at the guts of the iPhone, I mean, Samsung and all these other people make all the different pieces. Even Foxconn puts together the entire phone. Apple doesn't even do it. And the hardware is really not very different from any of the other hardware out there. It's not exceptionally better or worse. But what Steve Jobs did and what he's so amazing for is he combined different disciplines. He really took innovation to a whole nother level in terms of looking at it not just as a hardware problem, but at how people use a device, their experience, what they feel, and how to bring in aesthetics from, design and art and typography into these different devices to make them much more human and in a much different experience than they would have with a more traditional device at the time.
So in this case, design is so important to function and to success, because there are a lot of great technologists out there. But if they're building something that to most of us is like cobalt is to the way we can operate a machine today, then it's not terribly usable and will not create that bump that we're looking for.
Yeah, it's amazing. In Silicon Valley, everybody says, it's the tech, it's the tech, it's the tech. And I agree, technology plays a very important role. But most of the companies that have become huge companies like Uber or Airbnb, Facebook, Twitter, their tech wasn't anything exceptional. But their approach to design, how they designed a new experience and a new way for people to interact, and their business model innovation, how they approach business, those are what, that's what set them apart. That's what allowed them to break through.
And when we look at those large behemoth dinosaurs that did not survive, would Kodak be one of the great examples of that?
Kodak would be a great example. I mean, they owned innovation. That's the funny part. They, you know, Kodak, they were like ahead of their time. There's also Xerox, right? Mm. And there's, I guess,
but they never
around,
did anything original, Stephen. That was
what,
a joke.
Xerox? Yeah, but you know, these companies, some of them were like very cutting edge for their time, but then they stopped. You know, Kodak stopped with film, and then they tried to do other types of cameras. What they missed, which is really the big thing, was that film was going away, that they could not rely on that business. It was going digital, and their move into digital was they were not competitive. They did not put the resources and the time into coming up with digital solutions that where they could lead the market. And in today's world, if you're not a market leader, you go away. I mean, you end up disappearing.
And what about Xerox? Why don't you go into their example?
Oh, yeah, Xerox. You know, they had Xerox Park. So Apple, Steve Jobs walked in there and got his best ideas by literally copying Xerox and all the amazing inventions they had, everything from like the Ethernet to the GUI, graphical user interface, to the mouse, all these things they invented. But that Xerox Park, like in so many big companies, was a little island off to the side. It was, they were given money and they were given some resources, but they weren't really given the attention or focus of the parent company. So Xerox itself was in the, you know, the line of making copiers and all this stuff, and they were making boatloads of money. That's how they could afford to fund this R&D center. But what they ended up doing, which so many big companies do, is they didn't even value what they were creating in their own R&D labs. And they didn't understand, the management really didn't see the potential of it. So they didn't know how to use it. So that was... So it ended up becoming an orphan for them, an orphan child. And Steve Jobs walked in there and he saw the potential, like so many entrepreneurs. He saw the applications and he put them to good use.
In your book, and it is a remarkable book, it really is, and
thank
I didn't
you.
Know that I'd be that interested in trying to figure out this whole innovation thing, because we've all read so many things about it in business books and in other you know, forms and magazines, but you have a wonderful way of presenting it. But let me scare people out there for a moment. Imagine moving up the innovation curve in the coming decades. No matter what you do for a living, you are part of this massive change taking place, and it will transform your job, your life, and your image of yourself. The changes will be profound and revelatory. What we can call work today will no longer be the domain of humans, and what we think of as our personal thoughts and experiences will be intertwined with those of machines. That sounds awfully ominous.
I wish I could paint a prettier picture. So what I think we have to get used to the idea is that there is no going back in time. We cannot go back to how we used to live, you know, 100 years ago, 1,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago. We can't go back to an agrarian society. Literally, with the world's population now, mm-hmm. we wouldn't be able to feed the world. It would be absolutely impossible to feed the world with technology, not to mention to do any of the things we all take for granted. So these machines are here with us to stay. Now, the machines are becoming more and more powerful, and the machines will end up being incorporated into more and more facets of our life. And in some ways, that will be very good for us. Like, we'll be able to do amazing things we have never been able to do before. A lot of the work that is sheer drudgery mm-hmm. will go away because the machines will do it. But at the same time, you can't undergo this momentous change that we're undergoing with the introduction of smart machines and not have society change along with it. So a lot of jobs that people do now will not be here in the future. These machines will take them over. The machines will take over even parts of our lives that we are used to doing. So things that we do on a day-to-day basis, like planning where we're going to go next, machines, AI, will figure that out for us. They'll schedule an appointment. They'll schedule a car. An AI-driven car will come pick us up. It'll take us to our next meeting. It'll inform us what we are there to talk about. And we'll trust these machines more than we trust ourselves. And the reason we'll do that is because they'll do a better job than we would do.
And are these machines that are going to be implanted in terms of our brain, I mean, that there'll be a chip that will really act as our own intelligence? What is this we're talking about?
The next step. So if you think it's weird just to have machines all around us, they're going to be inside of us.
I know people just have a really hard time imagining that, but I can believe you. But let me step back for a moment. You say that these advances in technology, aside from us not knowing how we're going to earn a living, that they are going to free us up for more creative work. And that's a good thing if we really can use it for that purpose and get away from the drudgery. But having said that, a lot of people are scared, saying, I'm not one of the higher functioning 10% in the society. I'm just an average guy. So what should I expect from this?
Well, if you're lucky, you will have machines that will put you into the top 10%.
But then everybody will be in the top 10%.
Exactly. There will be no percentage because we'll all be sharing a massive processing power from these machines that we don't have right now.
So what will separate us? I know that Howard Gardner has talked about the seven intelligences. Will it be our emotional capabilities? Will it be our empathy? Will it be something else about us? If, in fact, we can download all the knowledge in the world to our brains, then what will separate us one from the other?
Okay, what will separate us from one from the other? That's a great question. You know, what makes us unique right now? So that's what we have to ask. So in our lives, that makes us unique is our unique manifestation of our DNA, right? The DNA we carry and how it's formed our physical body, our brain, everything else. What also makes us unique is our individual experiences. We will still have individual experiences. We will still have our unique body parts, our DNA and our structure. Those will make us some of who we are. But we will also be able to, let's say if you had a chip in your brain, tap into computing power and intelligence far beyond what we would be capable of doing as we exist today. And this will happen. If you don't think it will happen, it's actually happening right now.
Really?
So they
explain.
It's amazing. So they have put chips in the brains of monkeys right now. And with those chips in their brains, these wireless chips, the monkey can actually control a robotic arm, and just by thinking, it can control that arm and feed itself. The monkeys in the laboratory with chips in their brain can sit in an electric wheelchair, and just by thinking, they can drive that wheelchair around, steer it, go anywhere they want. Now, if a monkey can do it, I think I could do it.
Well, you're a very brilliant guy, and you've started so many businesses. You've developed this concept of the founder space. You're working with accelerators, incubators on innovation. I mean, you're a remarkable man. But you say to us that, like Tom Petty, who was one of my great musical idols, when he wrote, you know, most of the things that I worry about never happen anyway. And I think he's right about that.
We'll return to this episode of America Trends in just a moment. If you like what we're doing here at America Trends Podcast, please don't keep it to yourself. I know there are a lot of people, John, who think, well, if I'm listening and somebody else wants to listen at the same time, maybe we're going to collide and they're not going to be able to hear us.
Yeah.
Is that the way the technology works?
No, there's plenty of bandwidth. Everybody can listen at the same time.
All right. Well, that dispels that myth. Now, you can do a number of things that would really be helpful to us. You could give us a kind rating or a review at Apple Podcasts, and that boosts what they consider to be our value and visibility. And what does that do, John?
Well, that puts us in the forefront so that you can find us easier, and most important is other people can find us easier.
And you can subscribe there or on our site, americatrendspodcast.com, or wherever you're listening, so we can alert you to new episodes of the podcast, which, by the way, We put out twice a week on Tuesdays and Thursdays. And stay in touch with us on both Facebook and Twitter at Trends Podcast. Or you can like us on Facebook or follow us where, John?
On Twitter.
On Twitter. Yeah. That's right. Where the world turns to hear fake news or whatever it is. Well,
not
you can
us,
direct
though.
Message
we
us at Trends Podcast or using hashtag Trends Podcast. And you know, John, with our growing audience, and really it's been pretty remarkable, a lot of people just came to us the last month or two and they might have missed earlier episodes. Can they get them again?
They can look through them and pick the ones they want to listen to. They're all on the website and a lot of them are up on iTunes, many of them.
All right. Well, listen, there's lots of material to listen to. We hope you have the time and will lend it to us because we try to make it worth your while. And thanks so much for listening.
And tell your friends.
We now return to this episode of America Trends.
But you say to us that most of the world's most pressing problems like climate change, food supply, yeah, habitat destruction, disease outbreaks, that all of these things are going to be resolved by virtue of this new technology and its applications and the creativity surrounding all of that. I mean, are we then led to believe that all the things we're worrying about, we shouldn't worry about?
So I don't say that exactly. What I say is that the technology has the potential to solve many of these critical problems,
mm-hmm,
the potential. But we still, as a society, have to realize that potential. So it's how we apply this technology. So are we going to, new technology get us out of the climate change problem? I don't know. But I will tell you that without new technology, there is no way in hell we are getting out of the climate change problem because it's happening too fast. And there are too many big players, who I don't even need to name on this radio show, since it's not political, that are really paying no attention to it, right? That are doing the bare minimum, which is not enough. So the only way out of these serious problems is through technology. But what we still need is the will on the political level and the social level to actually put the resources in to develop the technology to address these issues. They need to address the issues of food production. They need to address the issues of course, climate change. You know, how can we take control of our climate and reverse a lot of the damage we're doing with CO2? They need to take control of the issues of war, right? Can we use AI and other things to actually mitigate war and reduce the chance of another outbreak or another world war? All of these things are possible, but they're not inevitable. It still requires us.
Okay, very well said. Then how important is the work that you're doing to make certain that there are companies out there, creative types, who really can build the type of institution that is going to drive all of this change, and helping somebody who's got a lot of ability to really maximize the usage of this new technology in creative ways that will benefit mankind?
So the beautiful thing about our society and the world today, and especially about capitalism, is that it gives anybody a chance who has a decent education to actually go out there and grab whatever technologies are emerging and experiment, try new things with them. It's not a top-down approach. It's actually all this innovation and creativity tends to come from the bottom up. It's individuals and groups of individuals who see opportunities to actually make a change for the better, and a lot of times to make a lot of money by doing this change, hence the valuation of some of these startups. But really, many of the greatest entrepreneurs on the earth, like Elon Musk and others, are driven less by the money and more by the desire to actually do something, to actually really help humanity. And that desire and the ability to do that through our system are the best things we have going for us.
And you talk about the fact that there is no mythical unicorn, you know, this one technological breakthrough. It's the application of a lot of these new technologies. And you point to so many companies. And when I read this list, I said, yeah, he's right. I mean, what Dropbox does in terms of file sharing, what Blue Apron does in terms of ready-to-cook meals, and you mentioned Uber and Airbnb. You've got ones like Cabbage, Small Business Loans, Spotify, which everybody's using for music. And these were all generated generated by whom? What kinds of people? It's not that guy alone in his garage, is it?
It starts usually with one or two individuals who have an idea, and their idea is usually wrong. Because most people who just have an idea, it's just an idea. You don't know if it works in the real world. But they start down a path, and the path is a path of exploration. It's like, okay, I have this idea. I'm going to try to figure out if it really works. And usually what they find is it doesn't quite work the way they imagined. But along the way, as they keep trying different things, they figure out what does work. And when it does work and it's right for the market and everything comes together, it just takes off and it sort of carries them away. It's like they're usually running after their idea to keep up with it. That's how startups work. They're really, really, really hard at the beginning, innovating. And then when everything clicks together, boom, it just goes.
Now, as somebody who's trying to encourage all that creativity and innovation, can you see it from the beginning at your founder space or working with these incubators and accelerators? And by the way, he explains those terms in the book. We're not going to try to play with all that today on the podcast. We really want to get at these broader concepts. But Stephen, do you know when somebody's really got it or do you know what it is that they need to really bring it to market? What is it that you lend to the process?
When I run my startup incubator, I spend a lot of time sitting with entrepreneurs and asking them questions about their business, about who they are, about what they want to do. And I can usually tell you in a very short amount of time whether they will fail, like whether they are on the wrong track. I cannot tell you in a short amount of time whether they will succeed, because there are so many unknown things in the future that change and so many variables and information that nobody has a control over or even insight into at the beginning. But when an entrepreneur, I've seen enough companies. So when an entrepreneur comes to me and they say certain things, I could say, no, that's not going to work. I've seen that, you know, a dozen times already with other startups, and going down that path is a dead end. And I can try to help put them on the right path. But I can tell you some of the traits I look for in successful entrepreneurs.
Help us with that.
Okay. So there are a couple things. So the number one thing I look for when I talk to an entrepreneur is their level of curiosity. Like, are they really interested in the business they're in? Have they gone deep? Is it something like when you talk to the entrepreneur, do they only know the surface level? Or do they know everything about this business? Have they delved in everything? Have they read everything? Are they like just sucking in information? And they have so much information, so much knowledge, and a lot of ideas about their industry. Those entrepreneurs, I usually bet on. I think, wow, they have something special. And then I like to see in their path that they are the type of people who complete stuff. Like when they hit an obstacle, they don't stop and then try something else. They just figure out how to get around that obstacle. Like nothing will stop them. And then the third trait I look for is not them, but who they have surrounded themselves with. Who are their co-founders? So did they bring on the team really, really amazing, smart people, people with skills and talents different than their own that complement them? If they are the type of person who can attract great talent and lead them, that's the third essential element I like to see.
Now, I know you just got back from China, and in your book you write, I travel a lot in Asia, and I can tell you the Chinese, Koreans, and Japanese are just as talented as anyone in California, but they lack something that we have. So what's our secret sauce in Silicon Valley?
I will tell you our secret sauce in Silicon Valley, and that is that we are not just Californians. So I grew up here. I grew up in California, born and raised, and Californians aren't like exceptional in any way. But what is exceptional about California are a couple things. So number one is that we are lucky enough now to attract talent from all across America and all around the world. We are sucking in the best and most ambitious brains from China, Japan, Korea, Austria, Germany, you name it, South Africa. Those people, that are super motivated to take a, and risk takers. They will actually fly to Silicon Valley, even if they don't have much money at all, just a dream and the, and some capability of carrying it out, and come here and try to make it happen. That is amazing. And then getting those minds from all over the world, those different minds that have different ways of thinking. Each one of them, like if you're from India, you look at a problem a different way. You're from a different culture, thousands of years old, and you have from a different society. And you, when you approach a problem, you'll think about it differently. You put those people together in a small, concentrated space. You know, Silicon Valley isn't that large. They all start interacting with each other.
And you say that many of those societies are much more rigid and conventional than ours. We kind of accept the person who goes off on their own path.
We do. So we are giving these people freedom that they never had. So in their own country, they may have been freaks or outcasts or who knows, right? But when they come here, they fit right in. Because everybody, like I'll go to a meeting, a startup group meetup in Silicon Valley, and I'll say, they'll say, who's here who was born and raised in California? Maybe I'm the only one who raises my hand. You know, the only one. And people are from everywhere, and that's what makes it so dynamic. I don't think you have any place on earth that is at that level that we have here in Silicon Valley.
Even though that, I know, and Russia and some other nations have tried to simulate their own Silicon Valleys, they've never succeeded.
They don't. They can create startup hubs, like in China, because it's such a big economy now. You know, they have Shenzhen and Beijing and cities like that that are really vibrant. But they're still dominated by Chinese entrepreneurs. So they aren't as innovative. They're very vibrant. They have lots of energy. They're doing lots of stuff. But they aren't as creative because they simply don't have the diversity of thought and of experience and background that we have here in Silicon Valley.
Now, some of the things that you talked about, the ingredients that you need, the secret sauce, but you also write in your book, it's not creativity, the team, the customer, product, or technology. It's timing.
Yes, you need all of what you said before, but you timing, without timing, it doesn't happen. It's funny. It's like a great recipe, and if you leave out one key ingredient, it doesn't work. It's just not the souffle you thought it was. So you need all the ingredients in the right proportion to actually make it happen. And timing is really important. Because a change happens not linearly. It's not like a gradual change. Change happens in waves. And some of the waves are small waves of change, and other waves are like tsunamis, you know, that come and literally sweep over the earth and reshape everything in their path. So we are, you know, we can look at these tsunamis as they come, and you can look back and see very clearly, you know, the whole computer, when computers came out, when they first came out with IBM, the big mainframes, that was a huge change for the world, a huge change. Allowed us to do space travel and all these things we never dreamed would be possible without them. Then came the personal computer, right? And into our homes, and all massive change. Literally, the personal computer changed everybody's life and every business on the planet. Then came mobile. You know, like the smartphone, where your computers are in your phone. Boom, another tsunami, right? It just like swept across the world and, you know, changed everything.
So what's washing over us right now?
Well, right now, huge changes are coming. So AI. AI is this massive change. We finally got into the point where deep learning and artificial intelligence can actually meaningfully reshape how people do business and how people interact with each other. And we are seeing these new technologies go into this new AI technology going into every industry and taking over many of the functions we used to have to do manually or in a very cumbersome way with computers. So that is happening right now. Big data is tied into AI. And that literally big data means accessing lots of data with algorithms that allow these algorithms to learn and make more intelligent decisions over time. And then there are other technologies which are really cool. So we have the blockchain, which is basically enables cryptocurrency and tokens to be exchanged in virtual economies. This is changing a lot of business, including the finance business, insurance. Almost every industry on the planet will be affected by the blockchain. And then you have lots of new technologies that are right on the cusp of changing everything. And one of them is CRISPR, which is a CRISPR-Cas9 is a DNA editing technology that basically allows anybody with the right training to create new species of plants and animals out of their home. And do you know how much CRISPR costs?
How much?
You can buy a kit, a CRISPR kit, for under $500.
Wow. Yeah, we talked about that a little bit when we interviewed a woman who wrote a book called The Gene Machine. Fascinating stuff. Make Elephants Fly. Stephen Hoffman, and I want to give you a moment because I think really your book is different. To explain to somebody who really thinks they've got an idea, have a team, have a dream, and have some drive, and they think their timing is right, why this book, what will this book do for them and the process of radical innovation, or to enlist you or to come out to California and to be part of your founder space, what would you say to people who really think, I'm almost there, but I need a little help?
Ah, great question. So the reason I named it Make Elephants Fly is because when you have a dream to do something big, there's something that will really change the world, it seems at the first when you're starting, it seems impossible. The dream seems so big and so like unwieldy. How could you ever get this off the ground? How could you make this fly? So Make Elephants Fly was get those impossibly big dreams going. And the book really addresses this. So I spent the past 5 years working with hundreds of startups here in Silicon Valley and all around the world, going through the process with them. What do they do when they have these ideas? How do they take it from an idea, from just an idea, and get the feedback and the data and validate that idea so that it becomes real, and then take it all the way into a product, a new product, the type of product that actually can affect big change and launch it into the world? So it's really a step-by-step guide on how entrepreneurs have done it through case studies. I have lots and lots of case studies because I believe people learn best not just when you give them an abstract example, but when you show them how real startups have succeeded and what they did. And then I also spend quite a bit of time showing them startups that failed. And I explain to them in detail why these startups failed, so they can learn from the other people's mistakes too.
And if you had to isolate one that was successful and one that wasn't, that you think would be really illustrative of what you're talking about for our audience today on the podcast, very briefly, would you be able to do that?
Absolutely. Okay. Let me tell you about a startup we all know about, and how they failed and then succeeded. So there was a little startup here in Silicon Valley. They had a great idea. They were like, you know, this was back in the early days of the internet. They were like, we should create a video dating site. You know, wouldn't it be cool to have video dating? You know, you could see the other person, really get to know them and decide if you want to go out. So they built the whole platform to do this, and it worked beautifully, except for one thing. Nobody likes to be on video. For dating. People hate it. It's
you never look good enough. And
you never look good. It's awkward. You don't like how you say. People just didn't want, I mean, they fine putting up a profile and stuff like that, which people were already doing when the startup came along. But to do it on video, it just, people just didn't want to do it.
So too many risks involved. Yeah.
Yeah. They're stuck. They're like going nowhere. And they were like kind of frustrated. And then they discover by accident, almost, that they want to share a video of a party they had, you know, with all their friends. But video files are large and that you can't just email them to people. So what they did was they actually put the video up on their dating site, uploaded it, and just shared the link of the video. And all their friends could watch it, and they loved it. And they were like, wow, people don't really have a way to easily share videos online. What if we allowed them to do this? And they started doing that. And you know what they called it? They called it YouTube. Everybody started uploading their videos because it was so easy to share them with the friends and then other people they didn't even know. And they became the largest repository for user-generated video on the internet.
And what a remarkable thing they have established. And now they're the largest educational institution when you want to look at lifelong learning. There are many of us learning how to play piano, learning how to fix our car, whatever it may be. I mean, YouTube has now morphed into so many things.
And it started with such a simple idea. How can I share a link to a video online so my friends can watch it? That was it. And their initial idea didn't work. And so a lot of the startups I work with, they're like off on the video dating site, you know, but the good idea is just one step away.
Fascinating. I mean, what work you're doing, it is absolutely remarkable. And you're right out there on the edge of all this possibility. Stephen Hoffman, Make Elephants Fly, The Process of Radical Innovation. If people want to know more about you, your work, Stephen, give us some ways that we can touch in with all that's involved.
Oh, you can reach me a lot of different ways. So number one, you can go to makeelephantsfly.com. It's that simple. And I have a video there, the book, everything. And you can also go to founderspace.com. So Founderspace is our incubator accelerator. We have tons of free content, lots of videos, educational materials, everything. And I travel all around the world, so you probably bump into me somewhere if you look.
Absolutely. But don't leave him a message on his telephone. And
my
we can
God,
have,
don't do that.
We can have a laugh about that. Stephen, thank goodness we did connect, and it's been just a true joy and honor to have you on our podcast today. We'll get
thank
back
you.
In
you
touch.
You are wonderful. You are wonderful. I love your interviewing.
Oh, thank you.
I just have to say that.
Thank you so much, Stephen.
Thanks for listening to this episode of America Trends.